is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. Chances are you're familiar with America the Beautiful. You can probably even recite the first verse from memory. But Anne Marie Slaughter suggests we should take a closer look at verse 2. America, America. God, mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control. Thy liberty in law. It's that line about mending thine every flaw that Anne Marie Slaughter wants to draw attention to. The dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs suggests that humility, the importance of admitting fault, is one of America's core values. And she says it's one of several founding principles that is being ignored these days. Slaughter is out with a new book titled The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. She spoke about the book recently at the Commonwealth Club of California, and it's that speech we'll hear today on Word for Word. Anne Marie Slaughter has made her career in law and international politics. She also sits on the board of the Council on Foreign Relations. And here she is, Princeton University Dean Anne Marie Slaughter, speaking June 25th in San Francisco.
Thank you. I wrote this book because I was convinced that America has lost its way in the world, and I wanted to do what I could to try to help us find it again. I wrote it over a course of 2 years, and I looked back to our founders, I looked to monuments, I looked at our public buildings, our poets, our balladeers and composers. And when I was in the process of writing, I was in L.A., and I was browsing through a used bookstore, and I came across a book, dusty little black book, and it was called The March of Freedom by William Harlan Hale. Now, it turns out that William Harlan Hale was a classicist from Yale. He was a broadcaster for the Voice of America, and it turns out that he was an advisor to President Truman, but I didn't know any of that. I just opened this book, and there it was. And I started reading his introduction, and he said, and this was writing in 1947, he said that this book, which was subtitled A Layman's History of the American People, was, quote, one man's hunt for what he felt he needed most to bring home to himself. In other words, he, like me, in 1947, felt that America had lost its way, and he went back to American history to, as he put it, bring home some fundamental values to himself. He said, and now again, this is 1947, he saw the looming forces of, quote, greed, bigotry, and inertia. He saw a country with an atomic bomb capable of destroying anything on Earth. He saw a country, quote, accused of being overbearing and imperialistic. Does that sound familiar? A country, quote, so crisscrossed by our own divisions that we were stuck fast, incapable of living up to our own ideals. And I thought, 1947, from where we sit now, those look like the glory days. You know, we won World War II, 1945. We created the United Nations right here in San Francisco. We were looking toward the Marshall Plan. It seemed a time when America was both popular in the world and in a position to exercise great leadership. And yet, here he is writing that he feels that America had lost its way. I turned toward the conclusion of his book and found a story that brought home to me exactly what I was trying to do, and I'd like to share it with you. He was with the first American troops to liberate Dachau, and he describes going in with the American troops on a cold, windy day in 1945 in the spring. And he said that when they came upon the prisoners, even before looking for food, these skeletal men and women in rags started looking for bits of paper and cloth in their national colors because there was going to be a celebration, a ceremony of liberation. And they stood in their thousands with their flags, listening to speeches from different national leaders. And then came the Americans. And he says, an alley is made for the American commanding officer who comes and climbs up on a podium just like this one and speaks a few words of greeting and fraternity. And then when he finished, the great gate that the Nazis had built swung open, and three Americans marched in carrying our flag, a color guard. They advanced toward the platform, Hale says, and I thought they would climb up and mount our colors on it, impressively high. But at the last moment, on the colonel's signal, they wheeled toward the assembled thousands, carried our flag into their midst, and placed it there with the banners borne by men in convict stripes from a dozen victim peoples. And at this there arose a shout, a general shout of brotherhood and joy that echoed around the sodden walls. And Hale writes, I thought as I came away, this is what we mean, this is what we are. Should we seem to be less than this? Should we stand apart from the lowly, from the people oppressed for faith, from those who will not be bound? Then in spite of all our riches and our power, we are not what we set out to be. We were these people. We have led. And we can again lead their common aspirations. If we forget this, we forget ourselves. That's exactly the image of our country that I imagine, a country that flies its flag alongside other nations, not above them. The second thing that I read as I was writing this book was a letter written in September 2005, by Captain Ian Fishback, a West Point educated officer who has served multiple tours in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And he wrote a letter to Senator McCain that was then published in the Washington Post. And the letter said, I have been working in every way I can through normal Army channels to get a set of standards to govern interrogations. Because without those standards, we are seeing a whole train of abuses. And he said torture, he described murder. He said our soldiers need standards. But he said he'd been unable to get that set of standards. So he was writing Senator McCain, who, of course, himself had been a prisoner of war. And he ends that letter, and again I quote, by saying, do we sacrifice our ideals in order to preserve our security? Terrorism inspires fear, and fear suppresses ideals like freedom and individualism, individual rights. Overcoming the fear posed by terrorist threats is a tremendous test of our courage. Will we confront danger and adversity in order to preserve our ideals, or will our courage and commitment to individual rights wither at the prospect of sacrifice? My response is simple. If we abandon those ideals in the face of adversity or aggression, then those ideals were never really in our possession. I would rather die fighting than give up even the smallest part of the idea that is America. That's where the title of this book came from. I'd rather die fighting than give up even the smallest part of the idea that is America. So what is that idea? I put to you that it is the idea of a country that is bound together not simply by place, by common citizenship, certainly not by common ethnic heritage, common culture, or even common history, given that we are an immigrant nation. It's a nation bound together above all by a commitment to a set of values, to a set of principles that define us, that are written into our founding documents, that we often fall short of. And a great deal of this book is about how far we fall short of those ideals. But nevertheless, we continue to aspire. That's the idea. The values that I choose to write about as the components of that idea are liberty, democracy, equality, and justice. Now, I think if I woke any of you or indeed any Americans up in the middle of the night and said, quick, name me American values, I'm pretty sure you'd get three out of the four. I think, you know, you'd think liberty and justice for all. That's the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay, that's two. I hope somebody would remember all men are created equal. That's equality. That's three. And I'd like to think you'd think of democracy somewhere. So I think liberty, democracy, equality, and justice are not very surprising. The remaining three are tolerance, humility, and faith. Those I'm not so sure, particularly today, you'd necessarily get. But tolerance, of course, is the prerequisite for democracy. Without tolerance, without the tolerance of all those religious groups that originally comprised the colonies, without their ability to learn tolerance from one another, the Massachusetts Puritans, Roger Williams free thinkers in Providence, the Quakers, the Catholics in Maryland, the Jews in Rhode Island, and many other small religious sects, if they hadn't been able to learn tolerance of one another, they could never have come together. And today, of course, tolerance is a lesson we learn and relearn as a nation constantly. But without it, we can't have democracy. Humility. Now, this is the one everyone says, you've got to be kidding. Humility? Humility? How about arrogance? Well, I certainly agree that right now we're not doing a great job of projecting humility either to ourselves or certainly not to anywhere in the world. But in fact, again, if you go back to our founders, you'll find an astonishing amount of humility. George Washington, to begin with, began or somewhere in every speech talked about his own faults. He would say, this is from his farewell address, he says, I am too sensible of my defects not to think it probable that I may have committed many errors. Can you imagine a president saying that today? Whatever they may be, I fervently beseech the Almighty to avert or mitigate the evils to which they may tend. It's interesting, George Washington was a general. Our generals, Lincoln at the Gettysburg Address, which is deeply humble in the face of the sacrifice of the soldiers, and Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower said at a speech at London's Guildhall right at the end of World War II, humility must always be the portion of any man who receives acclaim earned in the blood of his followers and the sacrifices of his friends. Humility defined that way is actually simply the awareness of your relative smallness in the face of larger forces, whether it is the sacrifice of your fellow citizens, whether it is the majesty of nature, whether it is God. And indeed, America is a deeply religious country, and all religions insist on humility. The famous City on a Hill speech, where it is now seen that we were proclaiming we were a beacon unto nations. In fact, Governor Winthrop says, if we don't live up to our ideals, and of course he was talking about specifically religious precepts, the eyes of all nations are upon us and we shall be shipwrecked before them. And at the end, he says, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God. In a more secular vein, I think most people agree that a belief in progress is a fundamental part of the idea that is America. You can't believe in progress if you think you're perfect. It's a very simple proposition. You have to believe that you've actually got things to learn and that you could actually improve. That is my definition of humility. One more quote. Everybody always sings the first verse of America the Beautiful. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, you know it. The second verse, I think, actually would behoove us to sing a little more. It says, oh, beautiful for pilgrim feet whose stern impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God, mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. God, mend thine every flaw. That's akin to our national anthem. So I put to you that humility is, in fact, a core value that has been recognized by our greatest leaders in our songs, in our founding documents, and the fact that we are not displaying much humility today is simply a mark of how far we have strayed from that value rather than a statement about what our values are. And finally, faith. And faith is refers to both the religious faiths of many Americans. We have always been a country of multiple faiths. We were different Protestant sects and different other Christian sects with some Jews. Now today, as I describe when I march into the Princeton Baccalaureate Sunday, which ends our year, we start with a Christian prayer, and then we move to a reading from the Quran, and then we have a reading of a Veda. We often have a Baha'i prayer. We truly represent every religion in the world. I always think John Witherspoon, who was the Protestant divine, who was the sixth president of Princeton, is probably rotating in his grave. But in fact, this reflects all the faiths that America is and American people reflect. But also, of course, Enlightenment faith. And at our best, the religious faith of many Americans and our Enlightenment faith, our faith in the capacity of human beings actually to achieve liberty and democracy and equality and justice, go hand in hand. And that combination, the religious faith and the Enlightenment faith, faith in America itself, is a very deep part of who we are.
Anne Marie Slaughter is Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. She's also the author, most recently, of The Idea That Is America. She spoke June 25th at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
So those are the values: liberty, democracy, equality, justice, tolerance, humility, and faith. In each case, those values have been I think, misrepresented, even fairly severely distorted in our policies today in the world. And I'd like to give you just a couple of examples. Start with democracy. The Clinton administration and the Bush administration strongly recommend standing for democracy, promoting democracy in the world, as did the Reagan administration and the Carter administration. This is not just one political party's platform. However, if you go back to our founders, you can read the entire Federalist Papers. You will not find one mention of democracy, except where James Madison is telling you why it won't work. He refers to Athenian democracy, direct democracy, and he says, of course, that can't possibly work. And Alexander Hamilton, speaking at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, says, "We are a republican government. Real liberty is never found in despotism or in the extremes of democracy." So Hamilton is equating despotism on the one hand and the extremes of democracy on the other. Well, no, of course our founders believed in representative government. They had a very different view of representation than we do today. They, of course, thought that African-American slaves were 2/3 of a man, and women didn't even make it that far. Nevertheless, they did believe in representative government as a key part of safeguarding liberty. And they thought they were creating a government to safeguard liberty, and they thought representative government was part of that. But only one part. They equally believed in all the checks and balances they wrote into our Constitution, because they thought that power had to be checked at every turn. And they believed in rights regarding government. Their vision of what today we would call democracy is a liberal democracy, or a country that secures the blessings of both liberty and order, and does so through a popular government, an accountable government, and a rights regarding government. Now, that's a very different vision of what we ought to be promoting in the world, or rather what we should be standing for in the world, than a very thin definition of democracy that we use when we talk about democratizing the Middle East. It is a view of democracy that says it takes a long time, that you have to emphasize independent judges and minority rights and human rights generally every bit as much as you emphasize elections. That's how I would redefine democracy. Justice. Well, no, this one's, I think, much simpler. Madison wrote, "Justice is the end of every government," not just ours. And of course, our founders equated justice with the rule of law, and they equated the rule of law with equal protection of the law. That means everyone is entitled to rights under the law. Citizens and non-citizens got slightly different rights, but everyone had rights under the law. That understanding of justice simply cannot be reconciled with Guantanamo today, with the view that if you declare someone an illegal combatant, they have no rights at all. That is something very apparent to everyone else in the world who are effectively telling us you have lost any moral authority to talk about justice as long as you maintain the view that you can do whatever you need to do to extract information. Similarly, if you want to talk about justice, and particularly then counter-argument is, well, wait a minute, you know, that was fine, our founders could talk about justice, but we're facing a mortal threat. George Washington was definitely facing a mortal threat. We would not have existed if he, of course, had lost, indeed, the Battle of Trenton or the Battle of Princeton, right where I live. And yet, when his forces captured British soldiers and said, how should we treat them? The British have abused our soldiers terribly. He said, we should treat them with humanity. We should treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army. We were in a fight for our very existence as a nation, and he said, the fact that they treat us that way does not justify our stooping to their level. We treat them with humanity. Humanity is the watchword of the Geneva Conventions. Finally, let me talk a little bit again about faith, and if faith is a fundamental American value, how should it be reflected in our foreign policy? Well, for one thing, emphasizing the many different religions in this country and the tolerance of those religions in this country is a very important message to be sending in a world where we face extremism on the part of many religions, but in particular Islamist extremism. But equally importantly is to make clear that no one faith dominates our political life or our policymaking, that we do not decide how to give foreign aid or what restrictions to put on it based on the beliefs of one faith, but rather we are a tolerant society that recognizes the importance of the coexistence of many faiths. That would be a message to send to the world, a way of engaging the many different religions in the world, the many different civilizations in the world, that would be far better for us as a nation and would actually also start global dialogues of the kind that all religions, frankly, and civilizations need. So if you think about our basic values, and you think about how our founders created them, the ways in which they have been embodied in many ways through our history, I think you come to a very different foreign policy. But I'd now like to turn to another critical message that we need to broadcast to the world, but we need to remember ourselves. These values are values that we have always proclaimed, we have often fallen short of in practice. And indeed, in each chapter, it is a story of talking about liberty. But, of course, we talked about liberty when we still had slavery. We talked about liberty when we had colonies. The American Anti-Imperialist League was founded in Chicago with Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain and William James, a number of great Americans of the time who could not believe that we, the colony who had had a revolution, now had colonies of our own. And indeed, Andrew Carnegie offered to buy the independence of the Philippines for $20 million. It's pretty amazing. He was willing to put his money where his mouth was. So, of course, we have not always lived up to these values. Justice, right here in California, of course, we interned thousands of Japanese Americans with no evidence of their individual behavior that would give us any cause for suspicion, but simply because Japan had bombed us in Pearl Harbor. In countless other ways, inequality, we are still fighting for equality. But one of the things that comes through is that the Americans that we honor today are often Americans, almost always Americans, who have not simply gone along with my country right or wrong. They are instead Americans like Frederick Douglass in giving a 4th of July address to the Rochester Ladies Society, who have said, I don't know whose 4th of July this is. You talk about equality, you talk about liberty. Doesn't apply to me. Doesn't have any bearing on my American experience. Or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who read the Declaration of Independence by adding women next to men. All men and women are created equal. And when a government does not provide your rights, all men and women are entitled to cast off that government and start another one. Calling our government to account, pointing out the gap between rhetoric and reality. Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech. He said, I am convinced that the Bank of Justice is not bankrupt. But he was again saying, you talk about equality, now deliver. That's a different vision of our history. It's not a triumphalist vision. It's not a vision that says we are so great we can tell the rest of the world what needs to be done. But it's not either a vision that says there's nothing good about our nation or we shouldn't celebrate or feel justifiably proud about what we've achieved. It's a vision of our history that says we have great ideals, we are human. Madison, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. We are not angels. We are all too human. But we do have a creed that believes in a set of universal values, not just American values, universal values. Our history has been the process of individual Americans trying to hold our government to our values and making progress in fits and starts as a result. Karl Schurz, who was a German immigrant, a Civil War general, a Republican senator, Secretary of the Interior, truly a hero, said, my country, right or wrong, when right, to be kept right, when wrong, to be set right. Now is one of those times where it needs to be set right. Part of what we can do to set it right is to go back to our own history, our own understanding of our own values, and insist that our government live up to them. Thank you.
Anne-Marie Slaughter is author of The Idea That Is America, and she is the dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She spoke June 25th at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After her speech, Anne-Marie Slaughter took questions from the audience. They were read by Jeff Bell, a radio news anchor for CBS in San Francisco.
You opened the book, or in one of your opening chapters, you have a James Baldwin quote, which I love. And it says, I love this country more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. One of the ironies, I imagine, of writing a book like this in 2007 is that you could easily be accused of being un-American by writing this book, a book that is called The Idea That Is America. How dare you, some might say, question the basic tenets and values of our current administration of America 2007. Let's start there. There's a definite irony there, is there not?
There is, and one of the reasons I most wanted to write the book was precisely to remind all Americans that our greatest patriots had not gotten that reputation by simply celebrating who we were, but rather by insisting we be who we said we are. So, and at a time after an attack, and this has happened often in our history, after World War I, after World War II, after 9/11, there's a period of great fear, and people really do rally around the flag, and any deviation is regarded as unpatriotic at best, treasonous at worst. And we've seen a lot of that. We have seen people denounced for daring to point out the discrepancy between what we say we value and what we're doing. I think there is an irony there, but I also think the country is coming out of that initial period right after 9/11 and is aware that there are things going wrong. And if we can simply remind people that they are following in a great American tradition by holding our government up to scrutiny, I think we can push back.
We are a very polarized country right now, certainly politically, and I would imagine there are those who would be quick to categorize this book as either left or right leaning. you do a very nice job in the book of actually trying to take politics out of many of these issues. And I'm wondering how difficult of a process that was for you.
I'm a pretty deeply bipartisan person. I've just finished leading a 3-year bipartisan effort to rethink American national security. And actually, when I wrote the book proposal, a number of publishers didn't want to publish it because it wasn't partisan enough. They wanted a partisan attack. And I said that I thought, actually, people of good faith on both sides of the aisle would respond to this message, just as the people I write about are Republicans and Democrats. They are people from all across the political spectrum. And indeed, part of what we need to push back against is a culture that rewards partisanship. It's in the end up to us. If we reward people who give us a bipartisan message, either at the polls or in general public opinion, I think we can push back on that also.
Okay, well, I'd be remiss not to follow that up with some of the questions that are coming in about your thoughts on the upcoming election. Mm. And to paraphrase these, a number of those in attendance today would like to know if you think any of the current presidential candidates best reflect the ideals you discuss in the book.
Well, I certainly think if you read The Audacity of Hope, you will see a great deal of the same message. Indeed, I read The Audacity of Hope after this book was almost put to bed, and there were parts that I almost felt I'd written. It's a very bipartisan message. It is also a message, a positive message, but one that says, look, we need to pull together again, and we need to pull up our socks. I think even more broadly, though, what you are seeing a number of candidates running on a bipartisan platform. And Mitt Romney is, of course, a Republican governor in a Democratic state. If you remember, Hillary Clinton, before she ran, was working with Newt Gingrich on health care and other issues. And I think there are a number of the candidates who are claiming that we really have to turn ourselves around and want to do so on a bipartisan basis.
In the extreme, Michael Bloomberg, of course, is raising the whole issue of a third-party candidate being a big factor in this race. Thoughts on whether or not the time is now for a third party to be the spoiler?
That's exactly. I'm very afraid of a spoiler. I mean, if someone said, I think we need a third party in this country, and it's the party that captures the broader middle, and I'm going to spend 4 years creating that party, that would be one thing. At this point, when the race is already well underway and people have committed, what we've seen since 1980, and again with John Anderson and then with Ross Perot, is what it really does is tip the election to Ralph Nader. It tips the election one way or another. And that this election's too important for that. This election is an incredibly important election.
Before we move on from politics, I thought this was a very shrewd question. Do you think the term conservative today is vastly misused given the original value of our founders and our values espoused by quote-unquote conservatives today?
I do, and many conservatives that I know, who I count as my friends, are horrified at what is done in the name of conservatism. And their view is precisely conservatism is Edmund Burke. It's holding to your values. It's not changing very fast. It's not radical anything. So, yes, I do think it's being misused.
I want to cluster a couple of these sets of questions into domestic issues and foreign policy issues. Let's start with some of the domestic ones that might have to do with our values in general as you've laid them out. Do you believe that faith is necessary to American values? Could not democracy, liberty, equality exist without faith?
That's a very good question. Yes, in the sense that it is perfectly possible to be an atheist and to believe in all these values, without question. And indeed, as I said, I call these values Enlightenment values. And the Enlightenment, of course, is in many ways a rejection of religion, a claim that we can instead have a creed of humanism, of belief in human capacity, not divine capacity. And there's no question that our founders understood this as a humanist set of values, although you know, Thomas Jefferson is sort of interesting. He's a deist. He believes in a being, a higher being, but he doesn't believe in any particular religion. But you can believe in these values without any faith, without any question. At the same time, I think it is important to recognize, if you go back through our history, the role that religion has played, both in our, you know, actual existing in the sense of people coming here, but also our early presidents, our Abraham Lincoln, if you look at his faith and the role that played and the role he played, Woodrow Wilson. So what I tried to argue was it isn't necessary, but neither is it antithetical to those values. So to embrace Enlightenment values is not to reject faith and religious values, but at their best, they come together. At the best in our history, we've actually seen these both bolstering a common set of policies and a common set of values.
A couple questions about the particular words that you have called out, the particular values. To many, the idea of America is the American dream, financial success. You did not include this idea in your core values, but isn't the overemphasis on financial success what skewed our performance on the core values you cited?
Well, it is very striking that Thomas Jefferson and his co-drafters of the Declaration of Independence wrote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not life, liberty, and property, which, of course, was written into the British document after the Glorious Revolution. And I think for good reason. I think that our founders thought pursuit of happiness. Now, that can be through material means, that can be through non-material means, but part of liberty means you choose what is your happiness. So I would not want to denounce, to say, look, there's a contradiction between making money and American values. I think that's not consistent with our history. I do think, though, that as I write about inequality, we don't believe in equality of result. We believe in equality of opportunity. But we do believe in, and that means giving everyone a fair shake at pursuing happiness however they want to. And right now, the inequalities in our society, both income inequalities, but also, of course, health care, education, they mean that many people in America can't even get to the starting line. And that, I think, is inconsistent with our values.
Anne Marie Slaughter taking questions at the Commonwealth Club of California on June 25th. A dean at Princeton University, she is author of The Idea That Is America. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Let me read you three separate questions and then ask you to kind of cluster your answer. They all have to do with public service and with the input of the individual. Public input into and support of U.S. foreign policy is critical, yet the discussion of U.S. foreign policy remains the property of New York and Washington elites. What can be done to engage the public in deliberations about our role in the world? How much of a role does the populace play in our current state of affairs? And society's value placed, given our capitalist society's value placed on business degrees and CEOs over politicians, are public policy programs still relevant for students interested in government? If so, what is its role?
So I'll answer that last one slightly separately. But the first two, I think it's absolutely true that this is a time when we need a national conversation about foreign policy. And foreign policy and domestic policy are like this. I mean, obviously, unless we can figure out what to do about Iraq, we're not going to be able to focus on the things that we must do in this country. But similarly, the economic issues, the health issues, they are very intertwined. One of the reasons I wrote this book was to write a book as an accessible a way as I could to help start that conversation. It was my hope that book clubs across the country would be able to read it and debate it, that it would trigger debates about what is the idea that is America. You don't have to agree with me that what I chose is the idea, but most people have some idea, and that seemed to me a good basis on which to have a conversation in an election year. A lot of it, I think, is a question in an election year of making clear to candidates in meetings, in terms of writing letters to the editor, letters to members of Congress, that, in fact, voters see what's happening and care. Another critical point I'd mention here is so often when I talk about how we've lost our way in the world, the response is, well, foreign policy isn't a popularity contest. No. Foreign policy isn't a popularity contest, and if I thought we were standing firm on these values, I wouldn't care how we were being denounced. But the perception that we are completely hypocritical, that we do not stand for these values, is not affecting our popularity. It's affecting our power.
Do you feel America should exercise the old isolationist policy? How do you feel about America calling in payment for all debts owed the U.S.?
I'm deeply worried that the pendulum will swing from a particular form of international engagement, largely militarist international engagement, to no engagement at all. In other words, that we will go from where we are today in the Middle East to saying, we're just pulling in our horns. We don't want to do anything. We're just going to take care of our own interests. That is the wrong lesson to draw from Iraq for many reasons. Most importantly, the world is so interdependent that we can't pull back even if we want to. Our safety depends on the strength of a law enforcement system in a country in Central Africa or Central Asia. Our health depends on the state of a public health system in Western China or Indonesia if bird flu or other viruses break out. So we can't pull back. The lesson has to be we need to stay engaged in the world, but we need to stay engaged in the world in a way that doesn't say, it's up to us. We're going to democratize the world. We are going to show the world how to be, how to live. On the contrary, there are lots of other liberal democracies that stand for these values. We're just one country that has exemplified them as best we can in our way. The EU is another. There are liberal democracies in Asia and Africa and Latin America. We need to work with other countries, and that's the way we should engage with the world. And if we do that, we will find that the burdens will lighten considerably.
As you mentioned, humility is not a word that we might tend to associate with our current government all that often. What would a foreign policy grounded in humility look like?
Well, we've seen it before. I mean, the example I use, and there are many, but is Franklin Roosevelt. It was actually Hoover who started it, and Roosevelt picked it up, the good neighbor policy toward Latin America. You know, we'd been invading Latin America every couple of years, and we essentially had, of course, announced to the world that it was our sphere to invade, that nobody else could interfere in Latin America with the Monroe Doctrine. And Hoover and then Roosevelt said, you know, if we are to respect ourselves, we have to respect other countries. And we have to actually have a policy that is premised on respect. And respect is the manifestation of humility in the sense that if humility means, as I argue that it means, that it's not that you don't think you're any good, you have a justifiable pride in what you do, but you recognize you don't know everything, you can't do everything, you have things to learn from other countries, you respect their views. And I don't just mean you tell them what you're going to do and then you have them talk at you. I mean you genuinely respect their views. So I propose that today the best way to have a foreign policy based on humility would be to have a global good neighbor policy. And a global good neighbor policy would start on cleaning up our global neighborhood. And it would be based on a humility in the face of nature, in the face of the forces that we have unleashed that are larger than all of us. And that a global good neighbor policy, as well as being consistent with our own past, would reflect humility in the sense of taking other nations' views seriously and humility in front of nature.
A question about the culpability of our allies, Britain specifically, but other U.S. allies as well, in terms of a loss of ideals. Do you see a similar process unfolding with other countries in terms of perhaps movement away from their core ideals?
That's an interesting question. You know, Tony Blair advanced a moral foreign policy. I mean, the declaration of his foreign policy was in Chicago toward the end of the Clinton administration, and he really was advocating a foreign policy based on what I think he thinks Britain stands for, and I think he thought supporting us in Iraq was the right thing to do, in part because of the horrible things Saddam Hussein had done. I think he also believed that he needed to support the United States. But I don't think you could say the British have fallen away from ideals. Indeed, I think his unpopularity over Iraq was because many ordinary Britons didn't want to see their country doing the things that they saw it doing in the Middle East, I mean, e.g. invading without a UN resolution. If you read Sarkozy's inaugural speech, he sounds like he could be George W. Bush. He's talking about promoting liberty around the world. He appointed Bernard Kouchner as his foreign minister. Kouchner is the former head of Doctors Without Borders, who's a deep believer in humanitarian intervention. And the EU as a whole, interestingly, defines itself as standing for the very values Americans thought we stood for until recently. They stand for the rule of law internationally. They stand for multilateralism. They stand for foreign assistance. They stand for cooperation in the world. And if you read their sense of themselves, I think, yeah, that looks like America circa 1947 when he was writing this book, or 1949. So I think actually, at least in Europe, other countries are still strongly supporting these values.
Let's move into faith for a couple minutes here. You discuss in the book how you're talking about not just religious faith, but faith in humanity. And let's start with this question and then expand on it just a little bit here. Should the U.S. should U.S. policy in general not be so dependent on Christian religious faith, considering that so many other faiths are present in this country?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about, that I don't think it's right to say, you know, faith should play no role. Faith has played an important role. Faith plays an important role today in many Christian evangelical groups who are now making common cause with human rights groups in places like Darfur, who are sending believers all over the world, in part initially because they believe that their co-religionists are being oppressed, but increasingly that turns into human rights. But that's one part of the of American faith. There are American Muslims, there are Jews, there are Hindus and Buddhists, and as I said, all the other different mosaic of faiths. Our policy should reflect the fact that we are a society that believes anyone can believe or not believe, and that should be our image in the world as well as at home. So absolutely, it's not okay to have one set of believers determining things like foreign aid policy.
Here's a provocative question. According to some more radical historians, America was founded not so much on the principle of democracy itself, but to use democracy as a tool to mobilize lower classes to give up allegiance to the king. What do you think?
Now that's an interesting one. I thought the story was told a slightly different way. Gordon Wood tells the story that we wanted democracy, but remember, they only wanted representation for white men with property. So I don't see how that mobilized the lower classes. I mean, it was very restricted. And of course, even then, the Senate was elected by state legislatures, and you had the Electoral College. I mean, they were desperate to avoid anything that really looked like mass rule. But the story Gordon Wood tells is that once they had written in representative government and all men are created equal, the genie was out of the bottle. And that is a large part of the story. The next thing you know, white men without property said, why can't we vote? And then gradually black freedmen said, well, wait a minute, why can't we vote? And then, of course, the abolitionist society. And then women said, last I checked, I was human, why can't we vote? And on, different immigrant groups. So I think it's more that they did start a revolution they didn't intend.
I wanted to save this question for last, because I think this is a very shrewd question, given the timing of your book coming out today in 2007, specifically with what's happening in the war on terror. How do you respond to the argument that terrorists can and do exploit tolerance and equality and democracy so as to take power away from us and to end these values?
They do, but if they succeed in convincing us to take it away ourselves, they've won. This has always been true when we have fought a non-democratic enemy. It is always harder because we are an open society, because we do not censor information. The best response, there comes from the Israeli Supreme Court. Just let me find the Israeli human rights groups challenged the Israeli treatment of Palestinian detainees, and the Supreme Court came down. It didn't say you can't use enhanced interrogation or torture. It said you can, but the Knesset, the parliament, has to actually authorize it explicitly. And then he said, a democracy must sometime fight with one hand tied behind its back. Even so, a democracy has the upper hand. And I would say that in our history, what has proven true is that the commitment that our values, those very same values, engenders, the willingness of somebody like Ian Fishpack to say, I will die for those values, in the end mobilizes people to meet whatever threat far better than the determination in advance that we have to give up those values, as he says, sacrifice those values to make us more secure. We'll meet this threat like we've met others. And look at the British. You know, they stood in the Blitz, and we went and helped them. After the attacks on their subway, not as many people died as died in 9/11, but there were four attacks on different subways across the city. And the next week, they said, you know, we're back to work. That's how Americans should face up to this. And we should reject a culture of fear. You know, again, Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death. He didn't say, give me life at any cost. And I think we should just fight back and say, look, we're not going to let the terrorists win. We are going to stand for our values, and yes, we'll be attacked and people will die. And that has happened throughout our history, and it'll happen now.
Bottom line question, last question for you. What should people walk away with from this book, if only one thing?
If you take only one thing away, you should take away the point that true patriotism consists in, as I said from Carl Schurz, when your country's right, keep it right. When it's wrong, set it right. And do not be afraid to speak up and insist on your version of the idea that is America. It is not for our government to define it. It is for us to define it, to know it, and to keep it.
Dean Slaughter, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so very much.
Thanks.
Anne Marie Slaughter is Dean of Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She's also the author of the new book, The Idea That Is America, Keeping Faith with Our Values in a Dangerous World. She spoke June 25th at the Commonwealth Club of California. If you missed part of Anne Marie Slaughter's speech, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may visit our website, wordforword.org, where you can hear this week's show. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including sessions with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, writer and Dr. Atul Gawande, and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.